I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, the founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics company that automates the warehouse fulfillment process. Kiva robots deliver inventory shelves to stationary human operators who then pick and pack the product and send it off for shipping. Mick started Kiva Systems in 2003, and the company was acquired by Amazon for $775 million in spring 2012. Customers include Diapers.com and Zappos, both owned by Amazon, Saks Fifth Avenue, Staples, Toys R Us, and The Gap, among others. Prior to founding Kiva, Mick worked in high-tech product development at Motorola, Apple, and the online grocery company Webvan. Mick is a graduate of MIT and Harvard Business School. Welcome.
Thank you. It's fun to be here.
I want to start by understanding the traditional warehouse. Could you describe briefly the day in the life of a warehouse worker?
Yeah, the traditional warehousing, at least what I was experiencing in the late 90s, was characterized by a lot of conveyors and forklifts and other static, stationary shelving devices. Classically, a pick worker would grab a tote or a cart or some device and some RF picking device that might be mounted to their wrist, and they would follow the instructions and walk from location to location in the warehouse to find those items. And sometimes they pick an order at a time or multiple orders at a time, but they're going out to gather the inventory, bring it back to somebody else who's then going to do the pack out. And when we started Kiva, we turned that whole equation on its head and said, what if all of the inventory in the warehouse could walk and talk on its own and just come to you, the pick-pack worker?
A typical pick worker can walk 5 to 10 miles a day and spend, 70% of their time walking around the warehouse. I've heard you say before that regarding the experience of a worker, not only is this an unproductive way to fill orders, it's also an unfulfilling way to fill orders.
Yeah, it can be a kind of a rough job, and we're talking about direct labor in the factory setting that's probably being paid on the order of $10, $12, $14 an hour. And it's interesting for a while, but then it becomes pretty routine pretty quickly. Part of the unfulfilling part, at least, is that a lot of the technologies and existing processes don't allow you to do your job well. So you get to a location and you're supposed to get a red T-shirt and you're out of red T-shirts. And so then you end up spending all this extra time looking for where did they put the extra red T-shirts. And when obviously, we tried to change that whole equation with our approach.
With Kiva Systems, instead of the workers going to get the inventory comes to them. Can you describe that process briefly?
Sure. So instead of walking out to a location to get the T-shirts, we send mobile robots that travel on the ground out to get underneath a mobile shelving pod. It's an inventory pod that contains lots of different items. We pick it up just an inch or two off the ground, and then we drive that shelving unit all the way over to where the pick worker is standing. And then they present themselves in a serial fashion in front of the pick worker so that every 6 seconds they can reach out their hand and pick another item of inventory. It allows the pick worker access to every single item of the inventory without moving their feet.
How fast do these robots move around the warehouse? What's the mile per hour?
It's interesting. It's super slow. What we did is model the robots after the speed that humans would be walking, say, for example, in a grocery store, about 3 feet per second. And so when you see a bunch of them in the building, they're all kind of moving at a walking pace, yet they're getting a lot of work done very quickly because the human operator experiences a continuous pick face in front of them.
The warehouses look like a mini city on a grid system. It's like traffic, like cars moving around. How much did maps and the idea of automobile traffic play into your vision of what the warehouses would look like?
The way we approach it is less about like highway traffic and more about just a reservation-based system. So as they drive, they're reserving small stickers in this grid system, and as they get to the next sticker, they release the last sticker. Our software control system is probably more better described as an air traffic control system, which is deciding who gets to go when, where, and why. And then that creates this fluid set of motion amongst all of the robots.
Where does the name Kiva come from?
It is a Hopi Indian word that means meeting place of the ant people, or loosely ant colony. And so we use the term Kiva because our original logo was an ant carrying a package. It was kind of like the ant colony at your picnic that carries off all of your food.
Also, ants are complex organisms who are very strong. I think an ant can carry multiple times its weight.
True. I hadn't thought about the individual ant strength analogy until you pointed it out. But yeah, our robots weigh about 250 pounds and they carry a 1,000-pound payload around of shelving. But the real metaphor that I like is at the systems level, an ant colony is a very robust organism and it's really hard to kill. Mm. Once you get ants in your kitchen, really hard to get rid of them. So we are similar. Our approach to solving this warehouse inventory picking problem is to use hundreds and thousands, if not thousands, of robots in a building, all with a little bit of information, but collectively very capable of getting the work done and very robust.
One of the things that Kiva Systems does is track the popularity of a product. So let's say it's Valentine's Day. There'll be more pink candies being procured or fulfilled than Christmas time. So the robots are able to, the shelves are able to be moved to farther away from the human operators than those products that are more popular.
That's right. One of the side effects of making everything mobile in the warehouse is that you can now dynamically and adaptively tune the layout of the warehouse. And so as more chalky pink candy is being ordered, all of that stuff kind of moves to the front of the warehouse. But the day after Valentine's Day, as nobody's ordering that stuff, it starts to drift to the back of the warehouse and get out of the way. And traditional warehouses would have tackled that problem by bringing a crew of humans in over the weekend to re-slot the warehouse and move all that stuff around. And in our system, it just happens automatically.
I'd like to talk about the cost of the robots. A startup kit for these robots is, you know, $1 to $2 million. And if you have a warehouse of, let's say, 1,000 robots, that's, you know, close to $20 million. And it takes you, you know, 6 months to plan and set up the grid system. How did you justify the cost to potential customers in the early days?
There's a pretty well-known kind of trade-off, which we call the 2-year CapEx versus OpEx trade-off. I'll gladly spend $1 million if I'm going to save $500,000 a year for the next 2 years. Mm. And if you can hit that 2-year CapEx-OpEx trade-off, the automation projects tend to get approved pretty quickly. And in our case, to bring this disruptive solution to market, we had to do a lot of innovation around the business itself. We had to approach our potential clients with a brand new pricing model that took the risk out of the equation for them. So when they were thinking about converting from a conveyor-based system to a Kiva, we knew it would work, but they weren't quite so comfortable. So we'd say, look, if we get all the way to the end and you still don't like it, you can send it back.
You mentioned disruption. Kiva is a disruptive technology. It's not just a bunch of robots delivering products in a traditional warehouse. You really have changed the paradigm of the warehouse. What other companies do you look to who have been equally disruptive in their own industries?
There's a lot. Along the way, we used to think about who else has dealt with similar disruptive challenges when they grew their business. And companies like Southwest Airlines would come to mind. People always laugh about low-cost Southwest Airlines, but yet it's the only profitable airline over an extended 10 to 15-year period. And how do they do that? Well, they just take a very robust and simple approach. They use one aircraft, a 737, for all their flights. They originally had an open seating policy, so people really would hustle to get in and get their seats. And they took a very fun approach to flying, too. Another one we always used to talk about was FedEx. Today, you think about the ability to overnight a package from almost anywhere in the world next day. And that capability didn't exist, you know, 20 or I guess it was about 30 years ago.
Yeah.
It was unheard of.
We were talking about convincing customers to adopt Kiva, and your first customer was Staples. How did that happen?
The introduction, so we identified Staples as a likely consumer of the Kiva solution, and we had emailed into just about everybody we knew from every angle over there without much success. But when we were out seeking venture funding, the team at Bain Capital actually was able to introduce us to Staples.
Bain Capital was your investor, but they weren't among the early investors whom you approached. You got about 100 no's before you finally met them. What was the appetite among venture capitalists when you were presenting this idea?
The first few years would have been 2002 and 2003. I was still living in Palo Alto in the Bay Area. And so naturally, I was traveling Sand Hill Road, meeting with a lot of venture teams out there. And, it wasn't a great time for raising money. They were still licking their wounds from the dot-com crash of 2001. And we were a hardware play. And so at this point, they were looking for the next software company or some internet-type play that could grow quickly on unlimited amount of capital. And so, yes, to your point, we had the door closed in our face quite a bit. And they used to say things like, you're going to need $100 million to get this thing to cash flow break even, and then some. So I became convinced, actually, in those early years that maybe venture capital was not the right funding model for Kiva, this capital-intensive business. So I end up working my network, friends of friends, to find some investors that got it and that wanted to take a risk. I managed to meet up with a gentleman named Sam Kinney, who was one of the co-founders of Free Markets, which was a 1999 very successful internet startup. Anyway, I met up with him. He introduced me to additional co-founders and early employees of Free Markets, and we started to put together kind of a $1.6 million Series A round to get the company to do a proof of concept.
How firm was your conviction that you thought this was viable and this would work, especially in the face of multiple no's?
I knew that it could work, but, you know, as a first-time entrepreneur, CEO, all that stuff, I probably didn't appreciate all of the challenges that were going to be involved in building the company. But you have that kind of that naivete that actually makes you think you can do it, which is useful, very useful, actually.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, founder of Kiva Systems. We'll hear more from Mick Mounts coming up. Jessica Harris, this is From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, the founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics company that automates the warehouse fulfillment process. Kiva robots deliver inventory shelves to stationary human operators who then pick and pack the product and send it off for shipping. Mick started Kiva Systems in 2003, and the company was acquired by Amazon for $775 million in spring 2012. Customers include Diapers.com and Zappos, both owned by Amazon, Saks Fifth Avenue, Staples, Toys R Us, and The Gap, among others. So I want to talk some more about the early days of the company. You were sleeping on friends' couches, and what was your burn rate personally?
Burn rate on me physically, or burn rate cash-wise, the checkbook, all of that?
You tell me.
So the reason I was sleeping on people's couches is because I was keeping the burn rate near zero. I remember in that year, I think it was in 2003, something like 300 days on the road that year, 299 on other people's beds or couches, and one night in a Red Roof Inn because I just couldn't drive any further and had to pull over. And it said $29.99 for the night.
What was your social life at the time with such a nomadic existence?
I was single, dating at the time, so I didn't have a lot that tied me down or restricted me from kind of taking this leap with both feet.
We talked before about Staples being your first customer. How important was that in being a catalyst for other retailers to come on board?
Yeah, so Staples is a very interesting story. We had identified a list of about 25 customers that we just thought, if all of these customers are using Kiva, then we've arrived. And Staples was on that list. And we were pleasantly surprised at the conversation when they came by. Only kind of in the ensuing year did we put together the reasons why they acted so quickly. But they were in a hyper-competitive space, just office supplies, and it was them against Office Depot, against Office Max, against Corporate Express. All of these guys are effectively selling the same 3M yellow Post-it notes and red pens. And so how do you differentiate in that environment? Well, it's through your pick, pack, and ship fulfillment capability. And so Staples saw our stuff and thought, geez, if this works, we probably ought to know about it, and wouldn't it be great if Office Depot didn't know about it? And so in that competitive context, they moved very quickly to try it. And then we quickly followed with Walgreens, later with Zappos and Gap and some others. And I think there was a critical mass building. You could see some of the leading online retailers using our stuff, and so that became kind of a self-fulfilling thing where most people who wanted to solve this problem would come and talk to us because we had a lot of the key accounts.
There were other people who started Kiva with you, including Pete Warman and Raffaello D'Andrea. How do you know them?
So Pete Warman is my roommate from MIT. He was teaching computer science and as it related to e-commerce, and he knew exactly how to make this thing work from a software standpoint. And I met Raf through another friend of ours, Mary Lane Vandermeulen, who was sitting across the hall from him at Cornell as a professor. I showed him what we wanted to do with these robots, and this built on everything that he had been doing in his academic career with controlling complex systems. He's a controls expert that can make these systems operate robustly.
One example of a robot that he built is a soccer robot.
That's right. You'd put five autonomous robots on a little mini soccer field against some other university, and the 10 robots would go at it autonomously. And his RoboCup teams at Cornell were winning every year. And when I showed Raf what we were working on, it was almost like falling off a log compared to playing soccer. We had a controlled environment. We could put down a grid. Nobody can go in there. There's no opponent that you have to outguess. You just have to control these things. So he signed up pretty quickly.
You mentioned that one of your co-founders was your roommate at MIT. You've had a couple of other friends join the company and also family members. Your father worked at the company. What was his role?
That's right. So I would talk to my dad about every other weekend, and I could tell he was getting more and more interested and getting kind of sucked into the process. And one day I just said, hey, why don't you just stop what you're doing and just move out. He was in Phoenix at the time. Move out to Boston and work on this. It'd be much more fun. You can do it full time. I don't have to call you every Sunday. So he took me up on it and came out, worked in our supply chain group using his logistics background.
You have one sister who's a helicopter pilot for the military, but you have another, your older sister has joined Kiva.
She was a part-time assistant in our HR team for a number of years. And my brother-in-law, her husband, had a PhD in robot path planning. Go figure. So he and my sister Cindy and family moved from the Chicago area to Boston. She was the sole person in our HR department almost up until like employee number 100, all part-time.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics fulfillment company. Customers include Crate & Barrel, Timberland, The Gap, and Staples. Kiva Systems was acquired by Amazon in spring 2012 for $775 million. Incidentally, in 2008, you were watching the Beijing Olympics, and you've mentioned that the opening ceremony was in some way a parallel to what you were doing at Kiva. How is that?
Right, so in 2008, my wife and I are watching the Beijing opening ceremonies on TV, and they show 2,000 people on the stadium floor making art. And I said to my wife, hey, that was the idea for Kiva. Just put lots and lots of people on the warehouse floor, and they can do some very interesting collaborative things. Of course, we didn't end up using people. We used robots to do it. But I was fascinated by the opening ceremonies there because they were able to make some incredible artwork, and I was told it was all done without computers, but just peer-to-peer with them working it out amongst themselves and coordinating.
I want to go back to when you hatched the idea for Kiva. You had been working at Webvan, which is the online grocery delivery company that raised hundreds of millions of dollars of venture capital and went bankrupt, perhaps because they were too early for their time and they didn't have this logistics framework baked into it. Could you describe how you came up with the idea briefly?
Sure. I mean, my experience at Webvan was the genesis. That's where I was able to experience at least the problem firsthand. That company was taking online grocery orders, much like a Peapod or in New York City, a Fresh Direct. And what would happen is the cost of fulfilling the order, delivering the order, and having the customer support relationship, those total costs would completely overwhelm the margin on that grocery order. And so clearly, part of the reason the company went out of business was it was losing money on every order. And my job at Webvan was to think about next-generation fulfillment solutions. The internet was new. E-commerce was new. There hadn't been much kind of clean thinking around what does it mean to get one green T-shirt, one toothpaste, one can of soup in a tote, a box, or a bag. So this notion of each-based picking I felt was unsolved, and I racked my brain for a year over there trying to think about how to do this. The existing solutions just didn't stack up, and about a year and a half later, it was still bugging me, and that's how that's when I really got started on the problem.
We talked about Webvan's influence on Kiva's development, but you also worked at Apple starting in 1996. You were at Apple for about 3 years, and you were helping to move technology onto their desktop platform. This is also when Steve Jobs returned to Apple. Similar to Apple, at Kiva, you really control every step of the product chain, of the design, the aesthetic, the software, the robot operators, the stickers, everything from cradle to grave. And that's somewhat reflective of what Apple did. Can you explain that?
For sure.
That linkage?
That's right. So we're bringing a very complex solution to market, and we're going to put this in a customer's warehouse. So it just has to work. And so we decided to take the same approach that Apple did when they would develop a technology like the original iPod, for example. The reason it was in some sense so successful is Apple not only made the iPod, but they were involved in the USB interface to the Mac. They made the logic board for the Mac. They made the operating system that ran on the logic board, and they made the iTunes software that connected to the iPod. So rather than having to think through and deal with all those technologies, the consumer was able to just listen to music.
What are some of your memories of Steve Jobs? Like, are there any, random stories that come to mind from those days?
You learn a lot through osmosis when you see somebody like that. And I kind of had a front row seat for the turnaround. And when he got back in 97, the company was working on all kinds of different projects. And one of the things I remember was that meeting where he rolled out the new 2x2. We make desktops and portables, and we make consumer and professional. And if you're not in one of those four boxes, you can leave. Everything else is going to be shuttered. And luckily, I was in the desktop professional box. Mm-hmm. And then he said in that same meeting, so which one of these are we? We have this product, what are we missing? We're missing the consumer desktop. And so he had already developed the thesis and was working on his iMac vision. What I also remember about those days at Apple was everything became even more secret and super secret. And so I would, the guy in the product marketing manager in the office next to me would be working on the iMac and couldn't tell me anything about it, whereas only, you know, a year earlier we were all working on these projects together and sharing experiences.
How did you feel about that level of secrecy within the same company?
It was different, but it was completely understood that, geez, if your customer knows that the next version of the product is coming out, they're not going to buy the current version. So it was understood why.
Any other anecdotes, impressions of him?
Well, when I was working there, I used to tell my friends in the Bay Area, it's very interesting because he's so smart and his, you know, his passion and vision for the industry is really compelling, but I think he succeeds despite himself. And that, you know, with just small changes to the way he treats people or leads, he could be even more effective.
You founded Kiva Systems in 2003 and were acquired by Amazon in 2012. How did that acquisition happen? Did they approach you? Were they a customer of yours to begin with?
Amazon directly was not a customer of Kiva. In fact, that was the number one question that we would get from other clients or prospective investors was, hey, why isn't Amazon using this? In our sales efforts, we would make the kind of annual trip out to Seattle to try to convince Amazon that they ought to use a Kiva system in one of their warehouses for pick, pack, and ship. And in 2012, the conversation got more interesting as they said, okay, but if we're going to do that, we'd like to own the whole company.
Did you think that maybe they would try to build it themselves in-house?
That's always a real possibility, but I wasn't too worried about that because we'd been at it for, say, 8 or 9 years at that point.
Yeah.
And we developed a ginormous portfolio of patents, and we've solved a lot of hard problems. So even patents aside, some of the things we figured out how to do are very hard to learn. And so given that technology challenge, we weren't too worried about other people copying it.
At the time Amazon acquired you, you had been fulfilling orders for Diapers.com and Zappos, who were owned by Amazon. So perhaps that helped.
It did help. We think it helped. So for a moment there, we thought about changing our marketing tagline to say, buy Akiva, get bought by Amazon. Mm. We didn't end up doing that because then, of course, it happened to us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, the founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics company that automates the warehouse fulfillment process. I want to talk about your childhood. Where did you grow up?
So I was born in Frankfurt, Germany, in a U.S. Army hospital. My folks were my dad was in the military, so we had that classic Army brat upbringing where we were moving every couple of years somewhere new. I think I had 9 different schools by the time I finished high school or 12th grade.
What kind of child were you? What kind of kid were you?
I guess the funniest thing I can think about my childhood was when I was an adult already in my 20s, I took the Myers-Briggs test, and it comes out ENTJ.
What does that mean?
No, ENTP. So ENTJ is this classic leader profile where people who run companies, but I'm not that. I'm ENTP, which the tagline for that personality type was called One Exciting Challenge After Another. And I was showing it to my folks, said, supposedly this is my personality, and they started reading it, and they burst out laughing at the paragraph where it said, as a child, the ENTP, when asked to take out the trash, will spend the next 2 days trying to invent a system for the trash to take out itself rather than just doing the chore. And so they're like, that's you. That's absolutely you.
And along those lines, you tried to create, when you were, 11 years old, an automated process for doing your homework rather than you doing it yourself?
Yeah, my mom later, when I was running Kiva, sent me some old little clippings from the scrapbook kind of stuff that said, it was an essay, what do you want to invent? And I wanted to invent a machine that would do all my homework. And I feel like that was actually what I ended up working on at Apple, was my homework machine, the Mac.
Your parents were in the military. How were they as parents? Were they militaristic? Or
Probably quite the opposite. They just gave us a ton of support for whatever it was that we were interested in. So, you know, my father and my mother were role models and influential, inspirational in different ways. So my dad was the kind of hard work, work ethic, always had to be doing something productive. And then he also taught me sports, right? So he was a college football player at the University of Illinois, and I developed a love of sports by hanging out with him. And then my mother had a scientific curiosity, so she would take me, for example, into the laundry room at age 7 and turn out the lights and say, watch this, and open the dryer drawer and dryer door, and all the clothes would spark as she was pulling them out. Mm. And so there was a lot of little memories like that that contributed, I think, to both my competitive nature through playing sports and working hard, and then my scientific curiosity that my mother kind of instilled.
You used to exercise a lot before you started Kiva and having kids.
That's right.
Now you have no time. You did yoga. You played baseball at MIT for 4 years. You ran triathlons.
Yeah, it kind of goes away when you have a startup and you're doing 80 to 100 hours a week. But so I was fortunate in that my early few years at Kiva, with my schedule, I could really get in great shape. And I was in great shape when I started the company. And, of course, now with three little ones at home, my priority is to try to get some time with them in the morning and in the evening before they get to bed.
I've been told that you drink a lot of coffee. Just how much are we talking about?
Well, so the coffee, the caffeine is a mental stimulus for me. I actually did an experiment 1 year where I tried to go a whole year without caffeine and without alcohol. And it turns out I ended up going a year and a half without alcohol. Didn't miss it, didn't need it. But the caffeine, for after 4 months, I could barely complete a sentence. And so I had to start drinking coffee again. So I'll have a couple of cups of coffee in the morning, kind of the perpetual cup, and then switch to maybe one or two Mountain Dews in the afternoon.
Mountain Dew because?
The caffeine.
Mm.
And the sugar, I guess. By then, I need the sugar, too.
And you like Lucky Charms cereal?
Yeah, there was a period there when we were getting the company going that I felt that not only Lucky Charms was a nutritious breakfast, but that it was having some impact on our ability to win new deals.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks. It was a pleasure to be here.
My guest has been Mick Mounts, the co-founder of Kiva. Coming up, we'll meet Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment, including iPhones, BlackBerries, iPads, and recent Apple computers, among other items. The company was launched in 2006 and has recycled more than 1 million devices since inception. Prior to starting Gazelle, Israel worked as a research analyst at Goldman Sachs and a finance director at eBay and PayPal. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica.
Could you please describe how Gazelle works? Let's say I have a BlackBerry Curve that I want to get off my hands.
What you do is go to our website, either on the desktop or on your mobile device, and look up the specific model that you want to sell. You'll answer a couple of simple questions about the condition of the item, and you get a price. And if you like the price, you'll give us your shipping address so we can send you packaging, and we'll pay for the shipping. As soon as you put the item in the mailbox and ship it to us, we'll receive it, inspect it, make sure that it's as described by you, and then send you the payment.
Now, you're a consumer-facing business, but it hasn't always worked this way. You initially tried partnering with businesses when you first launched. Can you describe that experience and some examples of that?
We've gone through quite an evolution. So in the early days, what we wanted to do is access consumers that buy product, and what a better place than go to Best Buy, go to Radio Shack, go to Amazon, eBay, where consumers buy new product, and help those companies, those retailers, offer a trading service to their customer base. It just made a lot of sense. What the struggle was back then was that the economy was flourishing, the whole sustainability movement was just getting started, and frankly, this was not top on anybody's list.
And was there a catalyst or a specific event that really gave you the engine and the motivation to say, okay, we're going to change direction?
Yes, it's quite memorable. So we spent a lot of time with Best Buy. In April of 2007, we got a call in the evening basically saying that while they appreciate all the work that we put into developing the program with them, they were going to pass. We were running out of cash. And again, we either had to close shop or change direction in a very aggressive way.
You also changed course at an auspicious moment. The economy was collapsing, which ironically was beneficial for the company. How come?
It was very beneficial to Gazelle because the biggest opportunity was to build awareness that all the stuff that's in your drawers, in your closets, the 5-year-old BlackBerry, the 3-year-old laptop that you're not using anymore, has a value. It's collecting dust. So in the early days, it was really all about cash for your gadgets that you're not using, as opposed to where it is today, much more upgrading.
The number of devices that you accept is roughly less than 500. But back then, it was over, 200,000?
Hundreds of thousands, including movies and games and GPS systems. Was everything under the sun except for TVs.
And what percent of these devices are you able to resell versus that you're stuck with?
Everything has value. The only question is how much. From day one, everything that we acquired and paid value for, we are able to turn around and sell at the profit. So currently we resell 100% of the product, or if it's not 100%, it's 98%, 99%. The interesting thing about this business, which has always fascinated me, is that it's a supply-constrained business. Demand is insatiable.
You have spoken about the car trade-in business as an analogy to what you're doing. What parallels or similarities do you see, and what would you like to replicate?
Sure. So in the car business, 40 to 50% of all new car sales have a trade-in involved in it. So it's so consumer behavior around trade-in, to your point, is inherent in the way we buy new cars. That figure for consumer electronics is about 3%. Inertia is a very strong kind of human behavior, consumer behavior. When you buy the new, let's say, iPhone, you don't care a whole lot about the old device. It's sort of your ex at the time. So building awareness for the value of the devices and then convincing consumers that there is a service out there in Gazelle that provides a much easier, much more convenient, much faster, much much safer way to get that value for your device is a challenge, a marketing challenge for us.
So when you buy these devices, whom are you selling the used devices to?
I would say it falls into three different categories. The biggest market is in the emerging countries, Southeast Asia. It goes into the Philippines, into Malaysia. The Middle East is a big market, Nigeria. A second category of buyers are insurance companies. When you lose your phone, you drop it in the water, well, you're not getting a new one. The third would be consumers that don't get the warranty or consumers that want to buy a used laptop, a used iPad for their kids maybe.
They'll go to
eBay, they'll go to Amazon, they'll go to our store. Mm-hmm. On those marketplaces and buy directly from us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment. Personal circumstances caused you to move back to Boston in 2006. You at the time had been living in the San Francisco area, but your wife wanted to move back to her hometown in Boston. Can you describe that moment?
It was obviously a very important moment in our relationship, and we had an 18-month-old, we had an 8-week-old, two girls, and both I and my wife, both of us grew up with lots of family around us, and my family was in Israel at the time, and we tried once to fly to Israel from the Bay Area, and it was a complete disaster with the baby crying for 10 straight hours on the flight, and it was time to pack up, move to Boston, and be close to family. Hmm. And figure out the career stuff later.
Right. You mentioned that your family was in Israel. You actually were born in Peru and spent the first 5 or 6 months of your life in Peru. What brought your parents to Peru initially?
So my dad spent 25 years with the Israeli army He specialized in training of tanks. I guess at the time, in 1970, the Israeli army was in the process of selling tanks to the Peruvian army. I was born there, and they spent about a year there before moving back to Israel.
Were your parents in Israel when the country was founded after World War II?
Both of them were. My dad was born in Bulgaria, so he moved to Israel 3 years before the country was founded. My mom actually was born in Jerusalem under the British mandate.
You spent the first 18 years of your life roughly in Israel. What was the reason for moving to the United States?
Yes, so my my parents in the late 80s, it was actually pretty tough times in Israel in terms of a very prolonged recession. Nobody in my family has ever been to college at the time, and they just felt that education and just giving us an opportunity was their life mission. And I guess they said it's now or never. And just got on the plane and moved here with absolutely no prospects for a job.
So you get off the plane, and what next?
What next? So first, you're intimidated by moving to New York. It was really scary, actually, in the early days. My father scrambling to find a job, my mom looking for a job, I was looking for a job, and it was really all about survival.
What were some of the early jobs you got?
It was for a video store. It was 77th Street and Lexington Avenue, okay. Video Vogue, no longer there. And they were selling consumer electronics in the front. I grew up just loving watching movies. So the idea of working at a store, even was it $4 an hour, bringing movies home and watching them for free, was very appealing to me. I started working there and really didn't have a plan for where to take it.
What else about, just in addition to building a work ethic and having to scramble, how else did working in the video store influence
right.
you? I mean, there were electronics in the front of the store. Was there any resonance there?
Well, basically, the purpose of the store was to serve the clientele of the Upper East Side and provide the highest possible customer service known to mankind.
Okay.
So some of the customers were Woody Allen, Robin Williams, Ron Perlman, and they were just very demanding customers. So it was all about doing whatever it takes. But frankly, for me, it was a shock to the system. My first images were not kind of happy memories of watching movies. Was my first winter in New York, delivering movies on my feet while it was snowing and blizzards on the streets, going 10, 20 blocks on Park Avenue, Fifth Avenue, delivering movies to those glamorous apartments, mansions in Manhattan. Just my jaw was dropping every time I was dropping off a movie in some of those places. That was cleaning the toilet, frankly, and cleaning the shelves and making sure the store looked good and that it was welcoming to our customers. Those were their early days at Video Vogue.
So moving from Video Vogue to NYU, where you finally went to college and got a degree, what were your ambitions professionally? Were you just trying to make ends meet, or did you have some longer-term plan?
So living in New York, it was kind of natural to gravitate to the finance world. I don't remember the name of the book, but I remember a book that was written about the life of Ron Perlman. It was coincidentally a weekend day that he stopped by.
Ron Perlman being the
Revlon guy, the corporate raider of the 1980s, which started to get me thinking about Wall Street. The movie Wall Street obviously came out in 1987. And I feel that that's something that I could actually pursue.
What were your parents doing, incidentally? What kind of jobs did they hold?
So my dad was a limo driver, a car service driver. And my mom worked at one of the Israeli newspapers.
After you graduated from NYU, your first job outside of college was at Harvard Business School writing cases for them. And one of the cases you happened to help write was about Microsoft, where you went out to Seattle and you wrote about Bill Gates. Can you describe any interesting tidbits from that experience?
Yeah, that experience clearly planted a seed in me about the future of technology. And one of the things that Bill Gates said at the office, we spent about 3 hours with him. One thing that he said that I'll never forget was that Israel, one of the best ways to change the world is through technology, which has become evident over the years, obviously, with the companies like Microsoft and others. But for me personally, coming from my business background, my finance background, I frankly didn't know who Bill Gates was. I was barely using email at the time, let alone Windows. So that was a whole new world to me. Now, at the time, I didn't know what to do with it. Other than the fact that it was intriguing and interesting, I still had that Wall Street bug in me, so I had to go back and get it out of my system.
So you ultimately went to Goldman Sachs and graduated from HBS and got the Wall Street bug out of you. And then you begin a whole new chapter professionally, which is really in startups and e-commerce. Even though you were an employee at these companies, you still had this entrepreneurial itch because in 1997, actually while you were still at Goldman Sachs, you co-authored a business plan for a startup called Cosmo.com, which at the time was an internet-based video rental business,
right,
which at one point had a $1 billion valuation in 99.
Yes, they actually filed the S-1 in March of 2000, and they were ready to go public.
How did you come to be on the founding team of Cosmo?
So one of my cubemates at Goldman was the co-founder of Cosmo, and he came up with the notion of the idea behind Cosmo right after the Amazon IPO. He approached me because he knew about my experience working at Video Vogue. And we worked together for about 6 months, nights and weekends, developing the business plan, coming up with the name. And at the end of the day, he decided to leave Goldman and pursue it full time and build Cosmo. I decided to go back to business school.
Were there any impressions from that experience that you've carried with you?
That the world was going to change. It was pretty clear that the world was about to change and the internet was going to revolutionize everything.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment. Prior to starting Gazelle, Israel worked as a research analyst at Goldman Sachs and a finance director at eBay and PayPal. What were some important impressions from eBay or your PayPal experience that have carried over to Gazelle?
What was amazing about that time is to spend 2 years with entrepreneurs in those markets, building their companies from scratch, learning about their challenges of building a business, how they think about an exit strategy, whether eBay was going to buy them, an IPO, a different kind of partnership. So I just soaked up all that knowledge. That was really helpful for me to get a glimpse of what it's like to be an entrepreneur in all those different markets.
I want to go back to the early days of Gazelle for a moment. I want to talk about venture capital. In 2008, even though you had this auspicious moment where the economy was collapsing and people wanted to, you know, resell their items, the economy was collapsing. So, you know, venture capitalists did not have their checkbooks open. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, first thing I'll say, it was never easy to raise capital, in my experience at Gazelle. But the context of when you raise money obviously is critical. And you're raising a good point. So in late 2008, we were raising our second round of capital. So the first round was completed in 2007. Venrock, who incidentally was one of the early investors in Apple, was the lead investor of the Series A. Now, in November of 2008, we were ready to close the B round with Rockport Capital. And I'll never forget the day when we were going to close the deal. That was one of the days that the Dow was fell 1,000 points. And I was really nervous about, is this deal going to close? And I remember at the time, even the Rockport guys, I mean, they still wanted to pursue it, but everybody was getting cold feet. That was the week after the, I don't know if you remember, the Sequoia presentation came out about how the world was going to come to an end and investments were going to shut down and companies had to scale back their growth ambitions. And here we are, pitching a story about growth and about how this is the, you know, the recession and this dynamics in the market was one of the best things that ever happened to Gazelle. So it helped us push the deal through and get it done. But was it easy? Absolutely not.
You co-founded Gazelle with Russo Aurelien and James Michelini. Even before you came on board, Russo and James were seriously flirting with this concept, and they had borrowed $60,000 to buy used equipment that they then repurposed and sold on eBay for $500,000. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so that was fascinating for me when I met with Russo, and he was telling me that story in terms of the success they were having, and his point was, everything sells. Everything sells a good profit. The only challenge that we have is getting more equipment. And that was kind of the foundation for the idea for Gazelle and Recommerce. At the time, the whole consumer electronics business on eBay was a $14 billion business. There was just a lot of demand.
So it was Rousseau who had the initial idea for this re-commerce, recycling business.
Yeah, what I love the most about Rousseau is such an amazing guy. He's the true visionary guy. Amor, the guy with 2 feet on the ground, getting stuff done. He was really the visionary guy. What really sold me on joining him and James was his grand vision. And his grand vision was to introduce the concept of trade-ins into other consumer categories, starting with electronics, but also sporting goods, golf clubs, fashion items, IT equipment, servers, etc. So the vision was big. Now, pretty quickly after joining the team and we started actually thinking about developing a plan, we had to start somewhere in a narrow focus.
Now, Rousseau is from Haiti.
Yes. And we kind of went together through the earthquake in Haiti, where his parents' house was completely demolished by the earthquake, and they moved to the U.S. and kind of seeing him going through that period, you know, tough period in his life, his family's life was interesting and, you know, something I could definitely empathize with.
Simultaneously, while Rousseau and James were pursuing this concept on the East Coast, while you were still back west, you wanted to recycle your own mobile equipment. What was that story?
The story was before I was moved back here, it's before I knew about Rousseau, I went down to a retail store and tried to recycle a couple of BlackBerry phones. And I go in and I ask the guy how much for these phones, and the guy goes, $20. Said, $20, I can sell them on eBay for $75. And he goes, no, actually, we're going to charge you $20 for the privilege of recycling. And that was when I had this big aha moment. The consumers are not going to pay for the privilege of recycling. And that's how, you know, the idea of re-commerce kind of started to germinate with in my head.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
My guest has been Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.